You are listening to City Lights on WABE Atlanta, a celebration of the infinite ways in which people express themselves creatively. I'm Lois Reitzes. In this hour, we'll continue our tribute to To Kill a Mockingbird. We heard from author Maria Mills, who lived next door to and wrote about Harper Lee. In this hour, film scholar Eddie von Mueller joins me in the studio to talk about the movie version of To Kill a Mockingbird, starring Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch. Eddie von Mueller, welcome so much. Thank you so much. I'm still thinking about how you have an afternoon class to teach in, so I better talk fast.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, Lois. Thank you.
Delighted to have you. And here we have one of these movies that is a touchstone of American cinema.
Yeah, I think that there are very few films that, really in the history of commercial cinema, that are so universally well-liked as To Kill a Mockingbird. It's also relatively rare in that it was a critical success. It was a popular success. The actors all seemed to genuinely, you know, find some synergy together on the set. And one of the things that I think is really remarkable about it, it's the adaptation of a beloved novel. And adaptations of beloved novels always disappoint somebody.
Yes, and yet certainly Harper Lee wasn't disappointed. She was thrilled to have Horton Foote do the adaptation. Mm-hmm. And the thing about the popularity, its luster, how that's only continued to grow, it's remarkable to think that most Hollywood studios were not interested in adapting the story at the time. At least I read Robert Mulligan, the director, said that there weren't many Hollywood studios who thought there'd be much interest in a story about a middle-aged lawyer with kids.
In a small southern town. It's coming out in 1962 at a really pivotal turning point in the history of American cinema and, of course, in American history. The early 1960s, we are turning the corner into the civil rights movement becoming a sort of full-blown mass media, mass phenomenon. We also have, at the movies, we have really turned away from nostalgia and Americana, and we are seeing already in theaters, you know, another major film of 1962 is The Manchurian Candidate. Not exactly sunny.
Was Doctor Strangelove around that time,
too? Doctor Strangelove is actually a little later, but okay. We do have Dr. No.
Ah.
So if you think about Atticus Finch and James Bond as sort of two icons of movie masculinity, you're not going to find two more sharply contrasted figures. And this was a property that was viewed as a little too quaint, a little too sweet, and at the same time, dealing with issues of race, which, honestly, Hollywood cinema was not exactly eager to engage with issues of race at this particular moment. So it is a surprise that despite the warmth of the novel's reception, most studios were not eager to develop this kind of property. But Universal was the studio which produced it, was a major innovator in the early 1960s, and they were taking a lot of risks, and this was seen as a risky film.
What were some of the other risks Universal took?
Well, what had happened, Universal had been around since the silent era, a very old brand, but never one of the major studios. And what had happened is MCA, which was the biggest talent agency in the business, run by a guy named Lou Wasserman, sort of the quintessential agent. If anyone's seen Entourage, they know what an agency is supposed to be like. Mm-hmm. And MCA took the controversial move of moving into film production, and they merged with a record company, Decca. And in 1962, that merger was finalized, and what you have is sort of the first multimedia conglomerate. where they've got television properties, a talent agency, a movie studio. They're going to start studio tours. They're putting out records. It's a very slick operation. You know, this is the studio that's going to do Hitchcock's Psycho in 1960. This is the studio that is going to be developing all kinds of movies that are going to defy the production code that was regulating sort of content. So, you know, this is an aggressive, young operation, even though Universal was an old name. And it's interesting to see that company taking on this film, which is almost a throwback. It's black and white. It's not widescreen. It stars Peck, who'd been around for a long time, not, you know, a spring chicken. And it's this small-town Americana story. And it turned out to be a really canny move. The film was enormously profitable. But it's certainly not the kind of move you would expect a studio to make.
No. Talking with Eddie von Mueller, who is a member of the faculty in film and media studies at Emory University, we're discussing the film version of To Kill a Mockingbird on City Lights from WABE Atlanta. Scott Joplin's Rag, A Breeze from Alabama. Well, Alabama was certainly immortalized in Harper Lee's novel To Kill a Mockingbird and adapted into an award-winning, I think it may be fair to say, unforgettable film. Eddie von Mueller has chosen some clips for us from the film. Shall we start with the nobility of spirit?
You know, I think one of the things that is amazing about this film is the character of Atticus Finch. And here we are on the verge of Father's Day, and if ever there was the quintessential perfect dad, the ultimate dad has to be Atticus Finch.
Although they don't call him dad, they call him by his first name.
I love that bit. Yeah.
Don't let your
kids do that. It sets a bad precedent. But I'd like to listen to the clip where the title of the book comes from, To Kill a Mockingbird. Can I set it up a little bit?
Absolutely. I hoped you would.
This is a film and the novel as well that is as much about a community as it is about individuals. And the relationship of the Finches to their neighbors who are less well off is really an important sort of theme or subtext. And here they've invited home to dinner the son of a very poor sharecropping farmer, the Cunningham family, very poor family. And Atticus Finch's son wants nothing more than a rifle. He wants his own gun. And this is one of many little lessons that Atticus Finch teaches through sort of this homespun, very folksy, but very persuasive wisdom that he shares with his children.
Let's hear it.
We've been having squirrels and rabbits lately. My pa and I go hunting in our spare time.
You got a gun of your own?
Uh-huh.
How long you had a gun?
Oh, a year or so. Can I have the syrup, please?
Well, certainly, son. Cal, can you bring in the syrup dish, please?
Yes, sir.
How old were you when you got your first gun, Atticus?
13 or 14. I remember when my daddy gave me that gun. He told me that I should never point at anything in the house, and that he'd rather I'd shoot at tin cans in the backyard. But he said that sooner or later, he supposed the temptation to go after birds would be too much. And that I could shoot all the blue jays I wanted if I could hit them. But to remember, it was a sin to kill a mockingbird.
Why?
Well, I reckon because mockingbirds don't do anything but make music for us to enjoy. Don't need people's gardens. Don't nest in the corn cribs. They don't do one thing but just sing their hearts out for us.
Could we have many more layers in that message? Oh, God, and especially with the horrific news today of the shooting in Charleston. Such a gorgeous scene. And yet, I think it's striking that for all of the beauty of his humanity and the morality, Atticus does not come across as sanctimonious.
No. He lectures constantly, and you never once feel lectured at. I wish I could do that in my classes. I think that you mentioned the layers, and one of the beauties of Horton Foote, the screenwriter's adaptation of the novel, is how clear the messages of the film are without ever being made explicit. This is a very oblique film. There's no violence on screen. There's no blood or death or anything on screen. In fact, there are very few angry words even on screen, except maybe in the scene at the jail. Everything is done sort of through symbolism and analogy and allusion, but the story remains crystal clear, and that's very rare. Movies tend to be excessively obvious, and that's one of the virtues of the movies. Mm-hmm. You don't want to have to think too hard at the movies. But by the end of the film, when this idea of killing the mockingbird comes back, we totally understand. And I've shown this film to very young people and to college students, and I've, you know, watched it with adults who've never seen it before. It's surprising how fluently it speaks to those different audiences.
That it is a message of the importance of humanity, and certainly the mockingbird was Tom Robinson. Would you talk a little bit about the casting? Gregory Peck thanked Harper Lee for what he said was the role of a lifetime.
It certainly was. Gregory Peck, throughout his life, wanted to remain associated with this role above all the other parts that he had ever played. It made him an iconic figure in cinema. He was already a very popular actor, and he's in many fine films, but there seems to be a synchronicity in having him in this role. Both Philip Alford, who played Jem, and Mary Badham, who played Scout, remained friends with him throughout his and their lives. They called him Atticus.
Really?
When Peck passed away, most of his eulogists, a number of whom were affiliated with this film, talked about him as if he were Atticus Finch. So it's very difficult to imagine any other actor in that role. But it's also a film that gave the screen another one of its major figures, Robert Duvall.
Who doesn't speak.
He doesn't speak, but still has presence.
Oh, does he ever.
And that was actually Horton Foote's pick. Horton Foote had seen Duvall on stage in New York and actually recommended him for the role of Boo. And so it is entirely thanks to this film and to Horton Foote that that Robert Duvall entered cinema. And in fact, the screenwriter, Horton Foote, would later win an Oscar for Tender Mercies, which is one of Robert Duvall's sort of landmark efforts.
So much history. Talking with Eddie von Mueller of the Film and Media Studies faculty at Emory University on City Lights from WABE Atlanta. Thank you. Eddie von Mueller of the Film and Media Studies Department at Emory University is here talking about the film version of To Kill a Mockingbird. We've talked about the casting, about the huge role and impact of Gregory Peck, and it's still marvelous to see that this film is from a child's perspective, very true to the book.
I think it's always a challenge to adapt any novel. And I think one of the great challenges is because film is so different from literature, is sort of that sense of voice, which comes through so exquisitely in Harper Lee's novel. And how do you create a film with a voice? And I think that the filmmakers here achieve something almost unique, which is this is a children's film. It is, we are looking at the world from the height of Scout and Jem. And we don't see or understand really anything that they don't see and understand, and we understand it sort of through their eyes. And he manages, Mulligan, the director, Robert Mulligan, manages to pull this off without making a juvenile film, mm-hmm. without making a silly film. And one thing that all kids love, all movies that children will enjoy, involve children accomplishing something that grown-ups can't. Everyone, every kid, every teenager, you always love to see yourself validated. And one of my favorite moments in the film is where the audience understands that a lynch mob has arrived to dispense their own form of justice to the accused rapist, Tom. And Atticus stands alone at the jail. And there's a very strong sense that this is going to end badly. And it is the children disobeying their father and sneaking out of the house. It's the children who save the day.
Let's hear it.
Hank and his bunch is out chasing that old sheriff looking for us.
You know what he was, but we come in this other way.
Yeah, you ain't never thought about that, had you, Mr. Finch?
I thought about it.
I can't see Atticus.
Well, that changes things.
Atticus!
Jem, go home and take Scout and Dill home with you. Son, I said go home.
No, sir.
Well, I'll send him home.
Don't you touch him! Let him go! Let him go!
That'll do, Scout.
Ain't nobody gonna do Jem that away.
Now, you get him out of here, Mr. Finch. Jem, I want you to please leave.
No, sir.
Jem?
I tell you, I ain't going.
Hey, Mr. Cunningham. I said, hey, Mr. Cunningham. How's your entailment getting along? Don't you remember me, Mr. Cunningham? I'm Jean Louise Finch. You brought us some hickory nuts one early morning, remember? We had a talk. I went and got my daddy to come out and thank you. I go to school with your boy. I go to school with Walter. He's a nice boy. Tell him hey for me, won't you? You know something, Mr. Cunningham? Entailments are bad. Entailments.
So we have little Scout saving not only the day, but her dad, along with Jem.
And one reason why I think this film worked, even in the 1960s, even while we're seeing the opening up of the generation gap, even as attitudes towards authority in America, race in America, were starting to change, is the moral courage isn't exclusively situated in this father figure. Moral courage is something that children have.
Innocence.
That young people have. And that's certainly going to resonate in the 1960s when young people are going to become aware of their capacity to be agents of social change and, in fact, change the world.
Hmm. Were those children Southern?
No.
I didn't think so.
And actually, neither of them had extensive careers after that.
Yeah.
Which is probably good, given what happens to most child actors in the end.
Yeah. Well, Eddie von Mueller, this has been such a privilege speaking with you about this iconic film. I hope that perhaps you'll come back and talk some more film with us on City Lights.
I would love that. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being with us. Eddie von Mueller lectures in Emory University's Film and Media Studies Department. Coming up, we'll hear a review from Eddie's boss, Matthew Bernstein, the chair of Emory's Film and Media Studies Department. But don't worry, it is a film review, not a job review.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the line of a dark black night. This moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.